is not a drill. This is not a drill. General quarters. General quarters. All hands on your battle stations.
Welcome to Midrats with Sal from Commander Salamander and Eagle One from Eagle Speak at Sea or Shore, your home for a discussion of national security issues and all things maritime.
And welcome aboard, everybody. I am the aforementioned Sal, along with my co-host, the ever-genial Eagle One of Eagle Speak, and thank you very much for joining us for another live edition of Midrats. And I would like to throw out an invitation for those that are with us live. If you scroll down to the bottom of the show page, you'll find the chat room. That's a great place. If you have some observations you'd like to share during the course of the show, you can throw them right in there. Both my co-host and I will be monitoring that during the course of the show. So if you have a question you'd like for us to direct towards our guest, please put it in there. We'd love to steal your good ideas and claim them as our own. And if you have to run off and take care of some stuff on the honey-do list and you want to catch up on what you missed, or if there are some previous episodes of Midrats you'd like to catch up on, you can always get the full archive over at Blog Talk Radio, or just go ahead and go over and get the free podcast on Stitcher or iTunes, and that will make sure, regardless of where you are, you can always catch with the latest here on the show. And let's go ahead and plow into the topic for today, and we're going to focus on some big pixels here. Why do we even have a Navy? And if we're going to have a Navy, why do we need a strong Navy, and why is that Navy an essential requirement for the United States Navy? From the ability to project national will, the Navy in many ways is a hidden hand in everything that we do, from how much it takes for us to make our commute to how much we spend over at Costco. The Navy is there directly or indirectly that really enables not just our political liberty but also our economic success. And that's kind of the background and the foundation of the big pixels that we want to hit on today. And we've got a great returning guest to help us with that. Brian McGrath, Commander U.S. Navy, retired. Brian, even though he came from up north in the beautiful Mount Laurel, New Jersey area, he got some sense when he went to college and went to a proper place down at the University of Virginia, where he was, following graduation, commissioned as an ensign back in 87. He spent his career as a surface warfare officer until his retirement in 2008. He served at sea in the ship that I will pronounce USS Buckley, that I hear four or five different ways, DDG-84. And no stranger to the Beltway area, while ashore, Brian did four tours in Washington, D.C., including his final tour where he acted as team leader and the primary author of the 2007 Maritime Strategy titled A Cooperative Strategy for the 21st Century Sea Power. Since retirement, he's stayed within striking range of the Beltway. He's been active in a variety of roles in presidential politics, first serving as the Navy policy team lead for the Romney campaign in 2012, and then as the Navy Marine Corps policy lead for the Rubio campaign this year. He's the assistant director over at the Hudson Institute Center for American Sea Power. He's also the managing director of the Ferrybridge Group, LLC, a small defense consulting turn. Brian, welcome back to Midrats.
Thank you. Gentlemen, it's good to be with you.
And did I pronounce your ship correctly?
The family pronounces it Bulkley. I think in England it would be pronounced Buckley, but here it's Bulkley.
Well, there's my Anglo-Saxon bias coming out.
There you go.
Speaking of Anglo-Saxons, some of our Anglo-Saxon brothers, most notably the Canadians and the Brits, and I give them credit for this, they started a series of conversations earlier this decade, and even a little bit before then, I think, but I first came into it after 2010, the concept of sea blindness. And how they're looking at sea blindness is the challenge of trying to explain to a nation at peace the importance of a strong Navy, sea power, and the sea lines of communication that keeps our economy going, not just for national security and war, but in the whole enchilada, especially for nations like Canada, the United States, and Britain that are maritime powers because of our mercantile nation and the fact to both sell and buy things, we have two large oceans we have to get across in order to get there. And part of that sea blindness has been the maritime community and national security writ large to explain to not just citizens, but also their leaders, their politicians and policymakers, about that level of sea power. And over the course of the last few months, you've been kind of doing your share at the retail level to increase the understanding of sea power, not just amongst those that were used to sitting in front of the conference table or sitting in front of a committee, but for citizens, leaders, and businessmen. And you've been spending time traveling throughout your area helping to address that issue of sea blindness and enhance the understanding of the role of sea power in our nation, not just in the macro, but also in the local level. If you could, take for a minute to outline for us where you've been going, what's the nature of your communications, and what are some of the bold-faced bullet points you want to make sure that your listeners have come away with and during your speeches?
Sure, thanks. You know, I do believe the United States, the general citizenry, doesn't really understand what it is the Navy does for the country. And I think it is up to the leadership of the Navy to explain that. It's, you know, Huntington's strategic narrative from his 1954 proceedings article, where you have to explain these things. You have to make sure the taxpayers are aware of what it is that they are sacrificing their hard-earned dollars to purchase and why it's important to do it. And so, you know, I've spent a good bit of the last 9 years, you know, since I retired, or 8 years since I retired, in a situation where it didn't look to me like Navy leadership was doing much of that. And to the extent that Navy leadership was speaking around the country about, or speaking about sea power, it was to audiences that generally already understood the need and understood the benefit. In the case of the Secretary of the Navy, I hadn't seen much from him with respect to what I consider to be one of his primary constituencies, which is the American people. He spent a lot of time on foreign travel and not enough talking to regular citizens. And so I just figured I got to do something. You know, my presidential candidate flamed out early. I wasn't part of either of the final two campaigns, the Clinton or the Trump campaign. So I figured I'm going to go do something. I'm going to help out. And I decided I would do a speaking tour, a Sea Power speaking tour. And I'm been going around the state of Maryland to Rotary clubs. And I chose Rotary clubs because these are people who are already comfortable with the concepts of sacrifice and service, because they do so in their communities. And I put together a presentation, a speech. It's about 18 or 19 minutes long, and it really is pretty straightforward. And it is designed to be an argument that builds on itself, and it sets out to answer five very simple questions. The first question is, does America need a powerful globally deployed Navy? The second question is, what does America need that Navy to do? The third question is, why does the Navy have to be so big? The fourth question is, what am I so worried about that I would come to this Rotary Club on this Thursday night to talk to 12 or 13 people? And the final question is, what can you do to help? What can you do to help ensure that the Navy and the Marine Corps get the resources that they need to do the things the country needs them to do? And I walked down an argument that is designed to be given to people who don't already know the problems and don't already know the answers. I mean, I spend a great deal of my professional life and a good deal of my personal time writing about sea power and speaking about sea power, but it's almost always with people who already understand where I'm going and generally tend to agree with me. And we nod our heads and jolly little ever gets done. And so I thought I would go out and see if I could start to talk to some of the unconvinced and the people that we really need to convince if we're going to make strides and provide for a Navy and Marine Corps that is aligned with what we need it to do.
It seems to me I remember back in 2007 or so, right after the maritime strategy that you helped lead us to at that time came out, that the Navy really made a pretty serious effort to go to Navy leagues and perhaps other associations to sell that concept and to talk about why we need a Navy. Is this something, this kind of... I don't want to say dog and pony show, but heck, I'm an old Navy guy, so why not? Just kind of dog and pony show, something we just have to do regularly to keep audiences reminded of how important the freedom of the seas is to the United States?
Well, I'm very familiar with they were called the Conversations of the Country, because I had to help set them up and run them. You know, I was skeptical at the time about the payoff. Because there was a lot of money that went into those, to putting those conferences on. I thought there was way too much preaching to the choir, because there was a good deal of reaching out to through the local Navy leagues, through the local international affairs organizations. You know, it was a good try. I don't think there was enough of it, and it didn't last long enough. I think what was probably more successful was, decades ago, the Navy used to have the CHINFO had a speakers bureau, and basically flag officers around the country were assigned to go and give speeches to civic organizations to help reinforce that tie. And so those conversations with the country were big, splashy things in big cities. They did, you know, a handful of them, maybe a dozen, I think, in all. You know, I've already done 15 of these speeches. Now, they're in smaller scales, but imagine if the flag officer community in the Navy were energized and given a copy of my speech or their own speech and just said, go out and start talking. This isn't, you know, illegal advocacy. This is telling people what you do. Send them out and do it. And I think that would be far more effective, you know, retail, as Sal said, rather than trying to do this wholesale, which was the conversation in the country we're trying.
I think one of the and I can feel that we share a common frustration here is this has been done before and it's been done right, but it's almost as if you have one or two primary advocates of it who have a certain PCS cycle. Somebody else comes in and is a little, you know, time for Wapner, doesn't like talking in front of crowds, so it falls out. And a lot of the talking that we do is exactly right. It's preaching to the choir. You know, it's one thing to go up in front and talk in front of the Navy League. It's another one to go and talk in front of the Rotary or other such organizations, where you may have people there that all they know about the Navy is the Blue Angels are really loud and their father really liked McHale's Navy. And it's not malignant, they just don't have that opportunity to learn. And this conversation, historically, I think, is really interesting. And it's funny how serendipity worked out. I found myself a few years ago, I went through a Hopkirk phase where I read everything about Hopkirk, and then I did a early Middle Ages jaunt. Now I'm kind of going back to source documents for our nation. And one of the things in early October that I read again was Thomas Paine's pamphlet Common Sense. So this argument, Common Sense, came out in I believe January of 1776. It does predate our Declaration of Independence. I just want to do a little quote here from your brother from history, and some of the comments he made in Common Sense about our Navy. A little bit of a long quote here. Quote: "No country on the globe is so happily situated or so internally capable of raising a fleet as America. We ought to view the building a fleet as an article of commerce, it being naturally manufactory of this country. 'Tis the best money we can lay out. A navy, when finished, is worth more than its cost. And is that nice point in national policy in which commerce and protection are united. Let us build and if we want them not, we can sell. Shipbuilding is America's greatest pride, and in which she will, in time, excel in the whole world. End of extended quote there. So there's the core argument. I don't think that core argument has dramatically changed since January of 1776. You're out there, and you've been down there talking at the level of the local level. Do you see in our either political leadership or even some of our senior leadership those that get it, those that don't just understand it, but are good at getting out there and speaking in such a level, not unlike Thomas Paine was doing with his pamphlet, to explain to the everyday citizen, this is why it's important and this is why you need to pay attention?
Well, this is the essence of my presentation, right? I one of the first things I do is I draw on the work of Peter Schwartz at CNA, and I make sure that the audience understands that this preference for forward deployed naval power that we have today, stretched around the world where our interests are, this isn't something that's recent, and it isn't something that's just since World War II. It has ever been thus. From the earliest days of this republic, we maintain naval forces wherever our commercial and our diplomatic interests were. The nature of those forces have changed over time, but what we ask them to do, but the fact of their existence, the fact that the American flag was flying wherever those commercial and diplomatic interests were, has remained constant. One of the things that I do to my audiences is I cite freedom of the seas is the reason for the United States Navy, and that freedom of the seas is so important because it is upon which our prosperity and our security rests. And I talk to them about, you know, as I drive, I live out on the Eastern Shore, so I drive to Washington quite a bit, and I cross that Chesapeake Bay Bridge, and I look, and I see the, you know, I see ships headed outbound from Baltimore with, you know, the products of our farms and our mines and our manufacturing plants. And I see ships headed inbound with consumer goods and raw materials for our manufacturing plants. What I'm seeing is the end product of freedom of the seas. And that, to this state, to the state of Maryland, means $59 billion a year in economic activity. It means 230,000 jobs that are associated indirectly and directly with that commerce, with those, with the cargo that moves in and out of that port. And then what I do is I aggregate it up and I say, well, if you take that and you spread it across 57 coastal seaports in the United States of America, we're talking about 23 million jobs. We're talking about $321 billion in tax revenue. And we're talking about $4.6 trillion in economic activity, or over a quarter of this country's gross domestic product. And then I ask them, what would it be like if great power war interrupted that commerce and kept that cargo from going to and from those ports? You know, I say that we lost 25% of our GDP once, and we called it the Great Depression. It took 5 years to reach that point. We could get there very quickly in a great power war, and that is what we have to be preparing for right now.
How does your audience respond to that argument, and do they see that, are any of them, because these are not people who are constantly looking at this issue, as you said, as the people you normally talk to are in the various places you go. Do they respond to this well? Do they understand why we have to spend so much on carriers? Do they see the threat to our carriers and to our other forces? Do they understand? Do they grasp that before you start talking or after you start talking? Do they ask good questions at the conclusion of your prepared speech?
They ask fantastic questions. They really do. And, you know, I watch the audience and I see their heads nodding and I see the first look of surprise on their faces is when I tell them that the Port of Baltimore is responsible for $59 billion worth of economic activity. They just don't get it. They don't understand that window on the world of global wealth and trade is so important to the state and to, you know, as an engine of economic activity. They have no clue that that is the case. When I go on to try and justify the size of the Navy, I remind them of the fact that we are, in fact, living in the Western Hemisphere, and it is not where the majority of the world's activity happens. The world's majority activity happens in Asia, and it happens in Europe, and that, you know, this country's national security strategy, unwritten strategy for 70 years, has been to try and see to it that no one power reaches a level of influence in either Europe or Asia that is equal to or greater than our level of power and influence in our hemisphere. Because if they did, they could lock us out of that activity, and they could lock us out of those resources. And so, no, you know, when people start to talk about the size of our Navy and compare it to, say, Russia or China, my answer to them is always, Russia and China are already where the action is. They don't have to maintain forces halfway across the world ready to fight at a moment's notice. We're the only nation on the face of the earth that has to do that. And one of the things that I remind them is that our Navy is the only Navy on the face of the earth whose main job isn't to fight other navies. Our Navy's main job is to influence entire nations. So as I walk them through this argument, I see a lot of understanding. I see a lot of learning. And then the questions are, you know, they run the gamut. They run the gamut from the cost of the Navy to what China's doing in the South China Sea to what Russia's doing in the Ukraine. I, you know, because of my background and the things that I talk about, I'm usually able to field the questions and anticipate them. But they're intelligent questions. They are thoughtful. And quite frankly, they're worried. People, I believe, I had one person say to me in Frederick, Maryland, why aren't our politicians saying this to us? Why aren't they telling us about, you know, getting ready for great power competition again? Why aren't they telling us these things? And I pointed out that there are some who do, and I, you know, I name names and I talk about how effective they are. But, you know, I reminded them that it's our job as citizens to hold them accountable, and that's how I end up my speech, which is to urge them to hold their elected officials accountable.
In your speech, you bring up two nations as you know, most people who follow it know exactly what I'm talking about, that, you know, potentially can challenge us at sea, especially, you know, looking forward as they improve their naval power, and that of both China and Russia. When you're out there talking to your audience and you have questions, because you mentioned both China and Russia, that can plant some seeds in your audience. I'm just curious, where do you get more questions? Are people more concerned about Russia, being that they've been in the news a lot recently for the Mediterranean and Syria, or do you get more questions with concern with the rising China?
I get a lot more questions about China, but I've gotten a couple of times very interesting questions about the conduct of Russian air forces in buzzing American ships and the discussion of the provocation and the danger and that sort of thing. Americans are worried about that, and I try to explain to them, you know, the concept of rules of engagement, the concept of being prepared, the concept of pre-planned responses, the concept of training against that kind of threat over and over and over again before you go over there. And I try to put their minds at ease, but I also remind them that this is what great powers do, and they rub up against each other, and that rubbing is where the friction happens, and the friction is where conflict happens, and we have to be prepared. And I think, you know, the best way obviously to be prepared is to be ready and to be strong, and that's something I reinforce with them.
How aware are they? I was just during the recent election period, I was with some people who were generally really politically interested in stuff, but they had no clue. I mean, absolutely no clue of the size and the growth of the Chinese Navy. How aware are the audiences you're talking to about what China is doing with its Navy and Coast Guard and maybe even its militia fishing boats? Do they have any clue about this stuff?
Well, no, I don't think they don't have a good clue on the either the qualitative or the quantitative improvements that the PLAN have made, or any of the other various organs of Chinese sea power. What they know about is the island reclamation, and they get on a visceral level that the island, they're not doing that, you know, to create resort islands. I reinforce that by explaining to them, usually in the questions and answers, that, you know, my sense and the sense of many analysts, that this is a way that they intend to project their defensive perimeter and to project this keep out zone, and that keep out zone is aimed primarily to keep us out. And I talk about, you know, our responsibility. We have treaty allies. We have our own trade routes that we wish to see remain free, and that, you know, it is up to the United States Navy to be able to operate within that keep out zone to a level that, you know, is consistent with mitigated risk. And we have to be able to show our allies that we're there and we're not going to go away. And sometimes that gets some very good conversations going about the role of allies and how much they give. And I talk to them about how much the Koreans spend and how much the Japanese spend on the bases that we're there. And then I also come back to the sense that at the end of the day, I don't wish for our security and prosperity to be in anyone else's hands, that I want our security and prosperity to be something we control, and that it is within our control, and it's something that we can do better on.
Eagle One kind of cracked the door open, so I'm going to stick my foot in it and push it all the way. Talking about the election, obviously everybody is still digesting the results from Tuesday, whether happy, sad, or confused. And part of that in the national security environment was the Never Trump group, that you have a fair bit of background and knowledge of the players who were there. And in essence, we had a large chunk of the center-right national security community really pushed back hard against the Trump candidacy. Were rather clear in what their concerns were, why they stood with the Never Trump environment. And since Tuesday, we've gone from Never Trump to, well, it's going to be Trump. And I just want to ask you for a bit, where do we stand now from both sides of the equation? You have literally, it's in our nation's interest that our best national security minds, regardless of who is in office, give their best information so we as a nation can get the best results from what we want. So you have the perspective of the Never Trump National Security Group on one side. You also have the Trump transition team on the other side who, from my humble opinion, if they're smart, they're going to look at the places that has the expertise. And I just kind of wanted to get your take on where we stand in this kind of an awkward moment. And is anybody looking to light up a peace pipe at any point to try to get the two together?
You know, I've been asked this question a couple of times this week by members of the press, and I've given them the same answer. And that was that, you know, I believe that both candidates were unfit for office, and I wasn't shy about saying so. Then my fellow citizens and I went to the polls, and it turns out that they disagreed with me in both cases, to the tune of over 120 million people voting for either Secretary Clinton or President-elect Trump. We have a president, and I wrote in my own blog last week and on various social media, he's my president now. And if his team asked me to come and grab an oar, I would have to take that request very seriously. And I think anyone else that was part of the Never Trump effort should also take that request seriously. And this isn't because I've had a conversion experience, but because he's going to be the president of the country I love, and I think he will need help running it. Now, had Secretary Clinton won, I probably would be giving you the same answer. You have to respect the office, and if they want your help, you have to give it fair consideration. But I honestly don't personally expect that call to come. You know, politics is a full contact sport, and I think I'm likely out for the season. I'm going to cheer from the sidelines as they work to build hopefully a 350-ship Navy, and I'll do everything I can to be helpful in whatever capacity I can. But I just don't know what they're going to do. I don't have any visibility. I really don't know anybody involved in the transition effort. And so my guess is there are plenty of people who weren't loud and proud and who will get phone calls, and they'll put together a team that will be capable of doing the job.
It raises an interesting issue of I think you've hit on it, respecting the office, if not necessarily the you wouldn't have put that person there. But, I mean, all of us who've served in the Navy may have worked for people we didn't find particularly palatable, but we end up saluting and carrying on with what they do. I wanted to ask about the maritime strategy, the cooperative strategy, and its iteration since the 2007 unveiling of it. How do you see that playing out? Does your audience understand that we're trying to get what we're trying to do with that kind of strategy of getting our friends and allies involved in certain ways?
Yeah, I've dined out for free on the 2007 maritime strategy for a few years, and ultimately, though, I in 2009 I advocated that it had been past its utility. I mean, the bottom line is the fiscal crisis and the rise of China, I thought, made its a lot of its sort of cooperative nature go away. And over the years, especially with the rise of China and the rise of a revanchist Russia, I thought Admiral Greenert was right in putting together an effort to revise it. The problem with that is it just took too damn long, and the world changed underneath them. And by the time they came out with their strategy, he was leaving office, a new guy was coming in. I haven't heard Admiral Richardson mention that document one time since he's been CNO. And I think that's probably good. You had the Obama administration there trying to tenderly do this little dance where we would pretend that there isn't great power competition. And what I'm hoping is that the Trump team, recognizes that we are back in great power dynamics again, and we have to begin to prepare for it. And the first step of preparing for it is to talk about it. Talk about it heads up. Now, guys like Bob Work have done phenomenal things in trying to push the ball down the field, even in spite of political headwinds coming from the National Security Council primarily and from the president. But I just don't believe that there is – I believe we have a really, really important moment right now. There are two things that cause strategy to change in the United States of America. One is a war. The second is a change in presidential administrations. And so there is a real opportunity right now to write strategy that will prepare this country for the challenges it faces. And these challenges are deep and they are whole of government. But I think maritime strategy is grand strategy, and this country, because of its propitious geography and because of its widely flung interests, really ought to concentrate more so on maritime grand strategy. And such a grand strategy could really have a lot of influence on things like employment, education, the economy. I wrote once where I thought we got the ends, ways, and means, thing that we talk about all the time. That applies to military strategy, but it doesn't apply to grand strategy, because by and large, grand strategy has the capacity to reorient ends, ways, and means to fit its own purposes. And so people say, well, we don't have the money to do that. Well, grand strategy provides that money because it reorients an entire economy in a way that could provide you with the ways and means that you need to achieve the ends that you desire. And I think we're at one of those moments right now, and we probably ought to seize it.
My next question really kind of ties together two questions, but I don't think you can divorce one from the other, because it's going to take the right person to make it happen. And prior to the election, President-elect Trump, he spoke in support of that magically round number, a 350 ship Navy. And there's been a little alignment in the stars that for a variety of reasons, one of the great representatives up on the Hill when it comes to understanding the Navy and Navy needs, Randy Forbes, Republican of Virginia, will not be returning to Congress. And he's been on everybody's short list as the Secretary of the Navy, and I believe he has also spoken out in favor of that 350 point. But to get from where we are here to 350 is going to have to take the right SECNAV with the right direction and guidance above him in order to make it happen. There's going to have to be somebody that understands the Hill, understands budgets. And kind of a big question that I'm sure you can boil down to the right point, but is Forbes one of those that would be on your short list? And when you look at that number, 350, given where our shipbuilding budget is right now and what type of upside potential we could have, especially when you have recapitalization of the SSBN with the Columbia class that we have coming on board, is that something that really needs to be much longer term build, or with the right leadership and the right budget priorities, could we get on a path to get to 350 with the right capabilities within a reasonable period of time?
So the first thing I want to say is I think I've read the press reports of Randy Forbes as being on the short list for SECNAV, and I think it would be an inspired choice. The Secretary of the Navy has several constituencies. The Secretary of the Navy has to work the Hill. I don't believe that has been done well during this administration. The Secretary of the Navy has to work the third deck, the Office of the Secretary of Defense. I don't believe that has been done well during this administration. The Secretary of the Navy has to work the American people, has to build a compelling vision of American sea power and sell that vision. I don't believe that that has been done well. I think Randy Forbes has great relations on the Hill, obviously, because of his couple of decades of experience there. He understands also the importance of working the minority over there because he worked side by side with Mr. Courtney on the House Armed Services Sea Power Subcommittee, and Mr. Forbes understands that to get things done, you have to have some votes from the other side. I think he would be an inspired choice. Now, there's nothing magic about 350 ships, except the fact that the president-elect said that that's what he wants to build. And I will tell you that doing so will require a Secretary of the Navy with competence and skill and vision and foresight, but it's not nearly as important as consistent and strong presidential support. The Navy doesn't grow. No part of the military grows without the presidential support. But the Navy in particular, because it is so expensive, because it is a capital-intensive service, you have to have the president behind you in order to build over time. President-elect Trump has said he wants a 350-ship Navy, and if he makes that a priority – now, let's face it. There are going to be other priorities. Mr. Trump has said he wants to spend on infrastructure investment. There are all sorts of things he has political capital that he'd like to spend on. If he spends it on the 350-ship Navy, we can get there. I know that because I spent all summer working on it with Brian Clark of CSBA. CSBA was assigned to write one of the three alternate fleet architecture studies, and Brian led that effort, and I will tell you it was one of the most professionally rewarding, in-depth analyses of what it takes to deter great power war. That's what Brian decided was going to be our thing. We're going to put forward an architecture that the Navy has that they will eventually get around to releasing, I'm sure, because it's unclassified, but it is a plan, and we came up ultimately with, by current counting rules, just under 350 ships, but we advocate for a smaller class of patrol ships that wouldn't be counted under current rules that would have taken us over 380. But roughly the same size Navy. Takes us about 20 years to get there, given the shipbuilding base that we have, but you can do it, and you can do it methodically, you can do it over time, but you have to make it a national priority. Mr. Trump does that, and his Secretary of the Navy does that, and his ASNRDA and the Undersecretary of the Navy. If that team works as a team, we can get there, but you have to stay dedicated to it.
Do we confuse potential Navy supporters with the various segments of our fleet? I mean, we have destroyers and submarines and amphibious ships. And you know, as we get into the world where we're now talking about distributed lethality, is that understood, why we're looking at that and why it's important to the Navy to have that concept, but also why we also have these other segments that, you know, I mean, sometimes it's hard to explain why we still have amphibs to people who don't really appreciate power projection. But how does your audience respond to those concepts?
Well, I mean, one of the things that I do with them is in the second question, which is what does the country need the Navy to do? I lay out, you know, freedom of the seas, and I lay out how that is done by, you know, all of these different ships. And then I go to this question where I say, I ask, you know, some people wonder whether or not we need to be able to be prepared to do these massive humanitarian assistance operations. And I say the plain answer to that question is no, we don't need to be able to do those things. But doing them sends a very, very clear message to people in the region that we're there. It sends a very clear message of the compassion of the American people. And the final thing I say is, and it sends a really, really clear message that the ships and sailors and Marines that are involved in those efforts were planned and purchased for far more violent ends, and that they can turn to those ends in a moment's notice should the need arise. And that need, the need for those amphibious ships is demonstrated every day. They are among our most useful ships. And so the question of whether the sort of segmented and striated fleet is appropriate for general audiences, I would say no. And in general, you have to kind of blend it all together. But you have to be sophisticated enough to change your argument depending on where your audience is. If you're up speaking to HASC staffers or SASC staffers, you've got to be able to striate and segment that fleet and talk about distributed lethality and talk about taking elements of offensive power and adding it to the amphibious fleet and blurring the lines between combatants and amphibious ships. You have to be able to dance that dance. And then you have to be able to generalize that argument for general audiences. And this is something that we need our leaders to do.
Just because the very idea of talking about getting additional funds going to 350 gets the mind going all sorts of interesting directions. But you know, one thing, and I hate to use the S word, but I will because it'll come out in conversations, but you know, cuts related to sequestration or when you're looking at getting savings from one POM to the other, there's been an approach that, you know, there's one instinct to do the salami slices, which has a variety of downside, and the other one is to take a leadership position and go, no, we're going to take certain wedges out. We're going to take out certain capabilities. Some of our allies have done that in the course of the last decade or two. For instance, the British got rid of their land-based maritime patrol aircraft. So whenever the Russians come nibbling around their submarine bases or their coastal waters, you have the Canadians with their CP-140s, the Americans come in with their PH or their P-3s. Even the French have come up to help protect the coastal waters of the United Kingdom, which is interesting. But that was a decision they made. We need to take out a wedge capability. So if you look at getting additional resources to be able to grow that fleet for 350, and you know, I think we can bring into this conversation the air wing as well that goes on top of the flat tops. Look in the other direction. Adding salami slices across the warfare spectrum, or are there certain wedges of capabilities? So as opposed to creating capability gaps, either recreating capabilities or enhancing some capabilities more than others, where would you think would be a good priority if we're going to go in that direction to put those resources that gain the national security the most bang for the buck if you're going to grow?
Hot production lines. That's what it's all about. More SSNs, more DDGs. Once they go to the Flight 3 DDGs, more Flight 3s, more LPD-17s. The LXR, will move along a LPD-17 a hull form, so I don't imagine the learning curve is going to be terribly steep with that ship, but it could be. The bottom line when you want to grow a fleet is you build more of what you already got. And that brings us obviously to the question of the LCS and the FF. I believe that the current plan is takes us to 40 ships, 28 LCSs, 24 of which will be out at sea, 4 of which will be testing whatever, and then 12 FFs. The problem with that plan is that we have a gap. There's a hole in the current shipbuilding plan with small surface combatants from I think it's 26, 27, 28, and 29. So we don't build any small surface combatants for 4 years, and that's a problem. And I think that gap has to be closed immediately. So the first thing you do is build more of what you already got. Amphibs, DDGs, SSNs. I think you need to put another carrier in the plan because if you're going to build a 350-ship Navy that's going to be persuasive in 3 different areas of the world, you're not going to do it with 11 carriers. You got to have, in my view, 13 carriers, but you can do it with 12 if you have at least one forward deployed. If you can build more of the hot production lines, if you can fill that small surface combatant gap in the 25 to 29 time frame, and then quite the only sort of new ship to be built that I would like to see is some sort of a fast patrol vessel, some sort of 600 or 700 ton lieutenant commander command with 6 or 8 surface-to-surface missiles that zorches around the South Pacific, that zorches around the East Med, that zorches up into the Black Sea every now and then. But a ship that can deliver a punch, that has a certain amount of self-defense, that it can survive the first salvo, something that makes that first punch less likely to be thrown, that makes the force that's out there more lethal and more of a pain in the butt on the other guy's side. And we can do that relatively quickly. Now, the numbers that get you to 350, that takes a while. You got to be in serial production over the course of time to get there. But we can arrest the decline. We are, let's face it, I believe we are 13 ships smaller. We will be 13, the Navy will be 13 ships smaller when Barack Obama leaves office than when he came into office. That's not we've got X number of ships on con. It doesn't matter. The Navy is smaller than it used to be, and the Navy's responsibilities are larger than when Barack Obama came into office. That mismatch has to be addressed, and we can do that. We can do that by building on hot production lines. We can do that by we can talk about the air wing separately if you like. It's something I have less expertise in, but I certainly have ideas about it. We can do this. If you want to do it fast, the faster you want to do it, the more you have to rely on hot production lines. The more you rely on hot production line, the more you may have to rely on ships that you don't necessarily like as much. That's just the truth of shipbuilding.
Eagle One, you there?
Yes, I am here. Okay. I had questions about how you got involved with the Rotary Club to give these speeches. And for those members of our listening audience that are like you, navalists of various sorts, is it a good idea for them to go out and try and do this same kind of speech giving to interested social clubs and other associations?
Well, I mean, if you think you're good at public speaking, that's step one. And then you have to test it, right? Yeah, I give speeches all around Washington. I don't know that I'm particularly good at it, but I'm certainly willing to try. I contact them. I ask them, do you want, can I come? I'd like to give this speech. I've gotten some press locally and elsewhere about this, and I'll send them the press clippings. And let, these are citizens that are getting together, and they love to have people come talk to them. So if you're willing to do it and you think you're good at it and you think you have something good to say, by all means, by all means. And if you want to steal my notes, I'll send them to you. You know, Sal can get that information to me, and I can get them back out to people. But you know, one message, many voices. I'd love to see that happen. I would love to see the Navy get its act together at a corporate level, and you know, put a speakers bureau together, and have the CNO telling his flag officers, I want you to go out and do one rubber chicken speech a month somewhere, every single one of you, and I want you to report back, and I want you to tell me what they said and what their questions were, and if you need help, CHINFO will send you a brief, and here it is. And you know, I want it to be. I want the Navy to get its act together and to begin to recognize that it needs to pay attention to its number one constituency, which is the American people. And I don't see that happening right now.
I agree with you. It would be a great way to flood the zone. But, you know, unfortunately, it takes a point. I wanted to, you know, you're talking about hot production lines and you're spot on there. And that is the short-term fix. But going back to a couple of nations that I started my conversation with, we're not the only ones that are looking at recapitalizing, especially in some areas with gaps. For instance, I read an interesting point the other day. You know, the Royal Canadian Navy's youngest ship is 20 years old. They're looking at recapitalizing that. The Brits are looking at building a new ASW, but multi-mission focused frigate as well. And, you know, back when I was a kiddie, the oceans were full of ships like we had that happened to be wearing foreign flags, where you're talking about a variety of nations that had the Adams class. The Spanish even built a version of the Knox class. We had three or four nations that built their own version of the Oliver Hazard Perry class. And, of course, we still see that in the aviation side of the house. Everything from the teenage fighters to F-4s to the C-130. I wonder if we're going to have this sustained push for development, is there anything to be gained, and do we have the national culture as such to maybe work with the Canadians or even the British, who are a little further along and might be too far along to be able to do this, to look at having some economies of scale and to share some industry and some systems, so we might have some commonality in hulls? Or is that something whose days have passed?
You know, I don't know if it's a commonality of days have passed. I've seen some suggestions recently of teaming with, like as you said, with say the Brits on their Type 26. There are some really great ships around the world and some great ship designs. We have some legislative hurdles to get in the way. We have a culture of shipbuilding here and a shipbuilding industry. You know, if we were building someone's design, whether that design meets our standards, I don't know these things. What I do know is that I look at the Joint Strike Fighter and I look at what trying to do to build three versions of a fighter for three different American services. And what a cluster that has been. And I think about the potential for such a cluster when you try to do international shipbuilding. I don't think it is quite as hard as what they were doing with Joint Strike Fighter, but it introduces churn, it introduces uncertainty that you know a American designed, American built ship class. What I would rather see is us to unscrew our acquisition system quickly and allow us to build, to go from concept to design or capability, concept to capabilities to requirements to design to construction faster than to add the uncertainty of international cooperation when we really need to get building. We need to start bending metal. We need to bend more metal, build more ships quickly. I think I'd rather put that off for another day and get to work with something that we can control within our own lifelines, as it were.
Yep, but the this is always a controversial topic on this show, but with the LCS, you know, and I, we've now got these improved model LCSs in theory being that will be coming through those hot builds pretty soon. How do you view those things? Are they primarily pickets that we put out at various choke points, and then if they get in trouble, we bring in the heavy artillery? Or and since those are going to be international, along with the Aegis, some of the Aegis ships are already international. Is that going to be an effective, one more effective way to get more ships out sooner?
Well, I mean, again, that's a hot production line, and in terms of numbers, that's our hottest production line, and you know, we're going to have 28 LCSs and eventually 12 FFs. The FFs, I think, are a significant step forward, both in terms of offensive lethality and defensive resiliency. What is most attractive to me about them is that they are, we are moving down that path, and we can have ships quicker from those two designs with capability, and then go back to the first 28 or first 24 and add capability as they come into their regular refits. Go ahead and put that surface-to-surface missile in, put the upgraded CWIP or some sort of electronic warfare system in it, put a CRAM system on them, build those things, you know, as they come in, increase their capability. But, you know, I think stopping at 40 is probably a smart thing. I would like to see us move to a proper frigate, as our British friends would say, and that's a ship that can move with the strike group, a ship that can move that has legs, that has 28, 29 knots, 8,000 miles at 20 knots worth of range. That's sort of a requirement that can defend itself and defend another ship or a couple of ships, and that can strike over the horizon. This is something that I think we can do. We've done it before. We did it very successfully with the FIG-7 class, which had its growing pains, but which we turned into something that we got a lot of use out of. And I think we can do that. I want us to fill that hole. I want us to get working now, to start defining the requirements of this frigate so that we are bending metal on a proper frigate in fiscal year 25. And that we can build this thing even as we build Flight 3 DDGs, even as we build LXRs, even as we build SSNs, and even as we build SSBNs. Because if you're going to build a 350-ship Navy, there's going to be something more than – there's going to be $22 billion a year or more in SCN, and we can make use of that. And so I think a proper frigate would be a nice thing for – you know, I think America's shipbuilders ought to be – putting that thing together right now. Their design teams ought to be, you know, in this, we don't have a requirement, you know, that wine, that doesn't cut water. You know kind of what they want. Get out and start to build a paper frigate. Begin to build momentum and begin to convince people that we can do this, and we can do it with offensive punch and defensive resiliency, and we can do it in fiscal year 25, and we can start to build those ships.
Amen and endorsed. And the best thing is there are some great ideas that our friends have put into ships that they've designed and built in the last decade that we could steal and improve from, and a couple of mistakes other people have made that we can probably avoid. Brian, we've come up to the end of the hour, and wow, it's gone fast. What I wanted to do is give an opportunity, if people wanted to listen to more of your ideas and your thoughts and keep track of where you're going, where's a good place for them to keep track of Brian McGrath? Also, is there something else you're working on that we could expect to see coming down the road? And third thing, where would you want the listeners to be focused, curious about, and looking out for over the course of the transition to the next administration when it relates to the maritime side of national security?
All right, so one thing I'm working on right now through Hudson is a framework for a maritime strategy to come out sometime after the first of the year, probably, I would think probably close to February. That's something that I've been doing in some spare time and trying to really look at geostrategy, one of the things that Brian Clark and his, in the fleet architecture that we worked on this summer, he put forward a new theory of conventional deterrence using conventional naval forces. And this is something that I think should be expanded one layer up, how conventional deterrence serves our national needs. I'm all over Twitter. I do most of my snarky commenting on Twitter these days. My Twitter handle is @conswahoo, which is short for Conservative Wahoo. I have a blog, The Conservative Wahoo, but that's mostly politics, very little naval stuff. Ray Pritchett's the loss of information dissemination, I think, is just that was a national treasure, and I love to write naval stuff for that. For no other reason that I could do it quickly and get it up there fast. War on the Rocks has a lot of good naval stuff. I write for them every now and then. I don't really know what to expect or where to expect it from. I just we'll start to see some announcements shortly, I imagine, on who is going to come into the government, and I expect to be on the shore cheering them on.
Beautiful. And thanks again, Brian, for joining us today. I'm going to keep track of you, and I hope all of our listeners do. This is an interesting time we live on, and nobody's going to get bored or complacent, I don't think.
Right. I don't think they will.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Brian. Really, really enjoyed talking to you today.
My pleasure, guys. Thanks for having me.
Yes, sir. And thank you very much for joining us for this edition of MidRats. Please be sure and join us next week, where our guest will be Mackenzie Eaglin from the American Enterprise Institute, where we're going to move a little bit past the maritime focus and look at the larger national security horizon for the next administration. Until then, I hope everybody has a great Navy Day. Cheers.
Farewell,